Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Continue Mission with James McCormick. But James, unfortunately, is not with us tonight. He's, I think he's at some festival. He's given a presentation there. I am your host tonight, Rich Kilblain, and always we have Father Michael Pacella on the show with us. Now, we're going to have a little change in the game plan tonight. As advertised, we were going to talk about Tulsi Gabbard leaving the Democratic Party. I think we want to also talk about AOC getting heckled. But after that, you know, Father Michael and I were talking. He's a Vietnam vet, and I've been doing some reading on the enemy side of the war. And I think our audience might find it very interesting to learn how we actually won that war, okay, and why the other side is willing to admit it, okay? Okay, with that, Father Michael, how are you doing? Are you out there? Unmute yourself. Well, I'm not hearing from him. Okay. All right. Whatever his technical problem is, he'll come on. Now, he can hear. He's giving me a text. Okay. So I will first start with AOC. All right. And if you go on the internet and you type in, you can actually pull up on YouTube and you can hear her get heckled by someone in the crowd. Not a crowd, excuse me. I should correct that. That auditorium was rather empty, okay? But the heckler, he sounded like a guy who actually voted for her. Wait a minute. Okay. So he actually had voted for her, and what he was challenging her on was the fact that she had not delivered on any of the promises she had made when they elected her. And I actually want to defend AOC on this, all right? Because it's really not her fault. It's the way the system was rigged. Because as I was listening to not just Tulsi Gabbard's comments about why she left the DNC, but also I was wanting to hear what others had to say about that. In particular, the Democrats, okay, and also why, okay, the timing of this. So anyway, there were several things. The biggest thing was the wokeness of the Democratic Party, all right, in the fact that Tulsi is a moderate and conservative in some areas, right? And she, if you go online, she explains why she joined the Democratic Party, because it was the values, the old values of, like, if you listen to John F. Kennedy, and some of the other great Democrats, what they've done, that's what inspired her. The problem is that they would be considered Republicans today. She wanted to stand up for the people, okay, against the elitists, okay? And what she has noticed, and this is a fact, you know, if you go out there and you read about it, the Democratic Party is the party of the urban elite. It has changed. It has morphed. And there's explanations to why. And part of it is, see, before, you know, Bernie Sanders is one of those guys who, yeah, he's a grassroots guy, okay? And Obama, you know, solicited a lot of money from, you know, his constituents. They didn't want to take the money from the wealthy contributors. They wanted to represent the people. Well, they shifted from that. There was actually a change in the Democratic Party several years ago, where they decided to start party changed, okay? But Tulsi Gabbard, thing that bothered her probably the most, she if you listen to her podcast, she will explain the wokeness of the party, okay? And what happened is that they try to silence anybody that disagrees with the party line, But she also pointed this out, and this is where I when I listened to the heckler with AOC, what basically the party is ruled by Nancy Pelosi. Anyone you vote, when AOC got up there and made all those promises, and Tulsi Gabbard made all those promises, that you're not voting for them. You're just putting one more person up there to vote the way Nancy Pelosi wants him to vote. And what Tulsi said was that anytime she tried to bring forth a bill and that Nancy would not even allow it go to the floor. She's like, let me take this to the floor so that it can pass or it can fail, but let people vote on it. No. If Nancy doesn't agree with it, it does not go forward. So AOC has no choice. She went up there. She made a lot of noise, and she got, made a name for herself. She got a few good committees. But other than that, she's a beginner. All right, so let me pause for a moment, and I'm going to go check and find out why Father Michael is I can't get him back on. Okay, he can hear, but he can't talk right now. So just be patient.
Can you hear me, Rich?
Father Michael, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know what happened. I had unmuted you before I came upstairs, and I went down. You must have got cut off or something and then called back in. Maybe that was it. Or maybe it was when I got cut off. But anyway, tell me, how you doing?
I'm doing good, thank you. Really looking forward to our discussion tonight. Really enjoyed our discussion last week. It's really resonated, and I've been contemplating on it. And I thought it was a very worthwhile discussion.
Yes, yes. And we had a discussion when I was asking you and James for the definition of treason, because it was very specific and I couldn't remember it. I had a brain fart. It's aiding and abetting the enemy.
Right.
So when anybody questions, did James Bond commit treason? She tries to defend it. She's going there, and there was there's like up to 300 people visited North Vietnam. Okay. But she puts on an enemy helmet, and she sits, for whatever reason, she sits on that anti-aircraft weapon seat. Okay. And she has a good explanation for it. But they have photos of her looking through the gun sights, putting her fingers in the air, mocking the sound of the bombs. Those photographs were aiding and abetting the enemy. Do you agree?
Yes. I met with an 80-year-old this week whose husband was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and she remembered better than I did the whole scenario that you just explained.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
Yeah, so that was really good enemy propaganda. She was played. She'll admit she's played, but she at least admits that the buck stops with her. And hey, did you watch Jim Burns' documentary on Vietnam? And I think he had her on there, or it may have been a different interview, but she came real close to apologizing. Have you heard that?
I've seen several documentaries on Vietnam and have learned even about some of the operations that we were a part of, but I don't recollect that one, and I don't recollect seeing her coming close to the apology.
Yeah, it did. She's taken a lot of flack. It okay,
mm-hmm.
But anyway, so do you know we won the war?
And the person that I have, General Flynn, and we talked about those who had
that's right,
messed over by their government and yet remained loyal, and we had talked about
yes.
that, and that was something that I needed to bring up because I just could not remember at that time his name.
Yes. Okay. All right. So we've got a couple alibis from, or you know, from the last show for anybody who's watching tonight. Okay. So let me start this presentation on how we won the Vietnam War and didn't know it. Off with a question. What does it matter? What does it matter whether we won or lost that war?
Well, can I say something as a Vietnam vet? We were demoralized by our own country. We were demoralized by our own country, looked upon, even when I went back in and I was at Fort Bragg, looked upon as losers, even by other American soldiers. When I went to college, of course, called the baby killer in class, and it was like we weren't competent. Yes, there were a lot of people that were drafted. I volunteered at 17, but so there was problems. We had drug problems, racial problems, but to say that we did not fulfill our mission is a lie. And you taught me that you have to wait a generation to let the dust settle before you can really, even if you were there, before you can really make that determination. And so I'm eager to ask questions, to learn from you tonight what you've discovered by investigating the other side.
Okay. Actually, there's kind of a rule in history, or no, I'm not going to call it a rule. I'm going to call it an excuse by a lot of my colleagues. See, as an Army historian, it was our job to collect the history that will be used for future. We were what we would call current historians, contemporary historians. We wrote about current events, okay? And the big difference between what we did and what a journalist does is, well, journalists pretty much are, you know, propagandists. But what we're trying to do is actually think 15 years down the road, 20, 30 years down the road, what future historians, what information what they will want. Okay, and we collect that. That's how I saw my job, and I was a wartime historian. The war in Iraq started, Afghanistan started the year after I was hired. Okay, I was hired in 2000, and within a year, I'm a wartime historian. Made 5 deployments to Iraq and 2 to Afghanistan, and then I got sent to Haiti. All right, now. And that also contributes to this question I ask you. But anyway, because when I challenge my peers and my colleagues that they should be collecting this history too, whether you deploy or not, you need to be busy collecting this. And their answer was, or their response was, well, you have to wait 35 years. Because it takes about 35 years before you get the enemy side. And as you know, I've written several books on convoy ambushes. And the thing I pointed out is the most perishable information we have is memory. I mean, I interview guys a year after they come back. And when I ask them questions, I just can't believe I've already forgotten that. And the first thing you forget are dates. Okay. So we needed to go after that as quick as possible. But when we start talking about, then we get the enemy side, and now we can write a balanced history, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's coming out. That information is coming out. I just finished, for anybody who's interested, I actually heard, I attended a conference on the Vietnam War. I heard him speak, and I bought his book. And was not disappointed. Pierre Asselin, he's Canadian, and when he was working on his PhD, he decided to. And what you'll do is you pick areas that you're going to become the subject matter expert on, and he chose the Vietnam War, And his advisor, academic advisor, said, well, why don't you pick the enemy side, the other side? Because everybody else is covering, you know, the American,
right?
I don't know about the Arvin. And so he did. He took that, and he went over. He spent a lot of time going through their and Vietnamese officers come through our transportation school over at Fort Lee. And I enjoyed talking with them, but they're still, everything they did still classified. So, so there wasn't much, but he did, there was histories written, but he interviewed people, and his book is really good. And I also pulled him off to the side after the, his presentation and picked his brain on a few things. And one of them is, the effectiveness of the Phoenix Project, and we'll talk about that later in the, as we discuss how we were actually winning the war, okay? And I finished that one, and the one I'm reading now is the memoirs of a North Vietnamese colonel, okay, who then became a journalist, Bieu Tien, I think is his name, and he joined the revolution. He was one of the first recruits under Ho Chi Minh, and this is before the French colonial war. Okay, so but what happens is he has a falling out, and so he writes his memoirs. He doesn't go into any detail of military operations. That's disappointing, but he talks a lot about the personalities, the conflicts, and things like that. And he's very honest about how brutal the communist reforms were. And it was interesting because the chapter on reform, or even, I think we're into the war, and he said, you know, how Lê Duẩn is the one who replaces Ho Chi Minh as the as premier, and he's the hardened advocate for a no partition solution. All right, and we'll get into that. But anyway, he admitted that you know the recruiting propaganda for getting North Vietnamese to go down and fight in South was imperialism. The Americans, they were the bad guys. And then he turned around. And we ignored the fact that we had foreign imperialism in our, you know, in North Vietnam. Who were, you know, it was the Soviet and the Chinese influence. The Chinese, and pretty much the Chinese were coming in and telling the North Vietnamese, you know, how to suck eggs when it came to implementing communism. And that is why their system, you know, the Chinese system didn't fit Vietnam. And it, okay. But to go back to that question, so what? Why, what does it matter whether we won or we lost? Okay. But you said something that resonated with me. And that is how, see, we're familiar with being called, look, I enlisted in 1973, tail end of the Vietnam War, and I got to Okinawa. We still had guys in my unit in Vietnam when I got there. I was in a first Special Forces group. And so I'm a Vietnam era and faced the same stigma that the vets had. You know, but see, the guys I worked with were all had, you know, typical combat veterans, cynical senses of humor, dark humor, you know. So when someone goes like, how can you shoot little children, you know, because you call them baby killers. I said, oh, right. It's not that hard. You don't eat them as much, okay? Or the other one is like, well, how many people? Well, it depends on whether you count pregnant women as one or two. Okay. we had all these guys, you like this stupid look on your face because they're expecting you to feel guilty. And you're just, you just turn around on them and make fun of them. Okay. Yeah.
The major thing that we did not receive any parades. We were hostily received. You know, now people, if I wear my hat, say thank you for your service. And I think you have a mandate, and you've done it through many of the records that you have kept and things you have written, and that is to bring healing to the Vietnam vet, because we're still having a lot of suicide.
I did not recognize that reunion of gun truck veterans. And what I sensed was it's like we made the mistakes. We paid the price so that others wouldn't have to make those same mistakes, which is really sad, because in the Iraq War, no one wanted to hear anything about Vietnam, and everybody wanted to reinvent the wheel, and they made the same mistakes, and they came to the same conclusions again. But it was my job. It was my job to interview go after the gun truck story, the convoy security story, record that, and have those lessons ready for the veterans. And this is what I'm going to get at. All right. So I ask you, see, it's one thing for the civilian side, the civilian treatise with malevolence. But you mentioned this, but how were you treated by the Army, you know, the post-Vietnam Army? How did they
not look
good at your service?
Not good.
Why?
Because, you know, I was able to wear my, we got a presidential, I was able to wear, you know, the different things from the Vietnam War, because they viewed us as losers.
So right. That's right. And I encountered the same thing when I tried to. I was like a broken wreck. It was a joke.
But I had the
ribbon.
I wore the ribbon.
And you had the combat
pants.
You wore the.
And right.
Yeah, you
and,
were.
You
I,
know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the thing
and,
was,
you know, just this
but in my
stripe and all that.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I was identified.
Case, mm-hmm. Right. Go ahead, finish. Don't hear.
No,
finish your, what you were
I was. I was identified, you know, with that era, which was not celebrated or appreciated. It was tolerated.
Right.
And I was, you know, it was hurtful to hear some of the things from those who weren't even there during that time. But
that's
yet they were judging me.
Of the myth that we lost the war. Okay.
Correct.
All right. And I've been in lectures and stuff like that. And the Vietnam vets are very bitter about the fact that they are referred to as losers. My mentor who spent two tours in Vietnam, and now him and I, we bust on each other. You know, Army, Marine Corps, stuff like that, and I hit him below the belt one time, and I said, "Yeah, but you lost your war," because he makes fun of, you know, Panama. Shit, it was over. It was the Sunday. I mean, that was like a live fire training exercise, and I'll admit, the bulk of the fighting was over before the sun came up. Yeah, I said, but at least we won our war. You did win yours, and he looked at me, and goes. Well, we're winning when I left. And actually, that's another, you know, I'm thinking of writing the book about, and I'm going, I have several titles I could use. Yeah, the how we won the war and didn't know it, or we were winning when I left. And every Vietnam vet feels the same way. I mean, you're calling me, you said we lost the war. Where's the evidence? Right? And the evidence is, this is where I've heard, whose flag flies over Ho Chi Minh City, former Saigon. And I'm like, but our army was never beat. And this is what we're going to get into, okay, is how the war was fought, and especially the North Vietnamese perspective on it. And they butts handed to them, okay?
Pocket
right.
money.
But they
was
knew there
of...
was three objectives. There was three objectives, and they only accomplished one. So, but the problem in the United States Army, and I don't know about the other services, I would tell you SF, for Special Forces, that was our high point. It's like everything, I mean, what we did in Vietnam, we knew worked. In fact, the counter-terrorist campaign that was conducted in Iraq and then Afghanistan was inspired by the Phoenix Project in Vietnam. And I've heard when they were developing it, I heard guys allude to the Phoenix Project. Now, it was not as brutal as far as I know, but who knows? The evidence may come out later, but we will talk about that. But for Special Forces, and that's the environment I grew up in, no, we always looked. But keep in mind, I enlisted, you know, I just missed Vietnam by months. And everybody who had, I joke about it, everybody who had enlisted one day ahead of me was a Vietnam vet and never let me forget it. So when I become a, you know, I graduate from the academy, I come back as a platoon leader. All my squad leaders and above are Vietnam vets. So for me, I was so close to it that I was always looking up to it and learning and listening to these guys, okay? But there's this gap. And the thing that bothered me is when I go over there and I'm trying to teach senior officers, primarily colonels, that's where I got the real resistance. And I kept hearing this term over and over again. It wasn't just from me, but it was from other people too. There's nothing to learn from the Vietnam War because we lost that war. That's what I was hearing in Iraq. And the war, the conduct of the war was nearly identical. When you get into convoy ambushes, there's differences. But the similarity, I did this one time. So, you know, it was one of my duties as the historian for the transport to teach, just like yours as a school chaplain was to teach. And so after my first trip downrange, I come back and there was no one in the school who was going to teach about the current war because no one had any experience at that time. So when I came back, I changed the format for my class, and I would go, how many of you think you're going to go to Iraq? And like all my hands go up. I said, would you guys like to? And they're like, oh, yeah. I got them now. And I sat there, and I would like, and I had this PowerPoint slide, and I would show them, like, okay, so what's the definition of a gun truck? Well, it's any wheeled vehicle with a crew-served weapon. That definition fit Humvee with no armor and a guy sitting in the back with a saw. Okay, that was early gun truck. But once they started getting ambushed and the IEDs going off, armor and armament, machine guns and law. Yeah. Okay, so I said, let me show you. All right, so this is serious. During that experimental phase, the hillbilly armor. A-putt armor and machine guns on every kind of wheeled vehicle, even a HET, this big tank hauler. Okay? I saw a HET, that's right. But I point out, and I said, I tried everything. And guess what? By the time I gave this presentation, there was three popular solutions. And I would show the Humvee, the up-armored Humvee with a machine, pedestal-mounted machine gun in the back. And then I would show them the 5-ton gun truck with the pedestal-mounted machine gun on the back. And then I would show them the ASV, the armored support, now I can't even remember what it's called, but now I can't even remember the designation of it, okay? But anyway, it's a four-wheeled armored car with a little turret on the top. And I said, look, these are the solutions that the Army came up with. Let me show you what the Vietnam vet. Now, the Humvee that a picture I show would have a box, an armored box on the back. And then I would show an up-armored Jeep with a box on the back and a pistol-mounted machine gun. And then I would show them a 5-ton gun truck in Iraq. And then the V-100, the ASV, is the V-100, but on steroids, built by the same company, but they gave it a different designation. See, they understood the stigma with trying to sell a solution from Vietnam to the current population, right. So they completely renamed it. It had no appeal. In fact, I remember going to a static display and from the factory, and the ASV was built by the same company built the V-100, Cadillac Gates. I think they were Textron by that time, subsidiary of Textron. But anyway, the guy was selling there, you know, who was there, I said, oh, so this is the V-100. And he got offended. It's like he had gotten the message. It is not. And he countered me. It is not the V-100. He knew what a V-100 was. And we're sitting there chatting stuff like that. And after he warmed up to me, he goes, well, actually, it's more like the V-150, okay? It has a bigger door. But the thing was, and I told him, I said, and at the time I gave the presentation, I told him all the problems with the V-100. Sure enough, my next year over there, I found out the ASV, V-117, I think that's what it is. But anyway, V-117, that's it, had all the same problems still. The V-100 M1117, that's the ASV. That's its nomenclature. And more. It was top heavy. It had so much armor, it was top heavy. So it's like, and what's weird is the only people, the transportation did not like the V-100, nor did the truck companies in Iraq. In Vietnam, the MPs loved the V-100. In Iraq, the MPs loved the ASV. So there was nothing new until the MRAP comes out, which was a South African solution, but they got that design from the Rhodesian Civil War that took place in the 60s. But anyway, so what I'm pointing out is that the United States Army, our armed forces, lost the war has led to this reluctance, except in the special forces community, to accept any of the solutions from the war.
Right.
And as a consequence, we had to relearn all those lessons in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I want to go back to what you said.
Go ahead.
We were winning when I left. And, you know, I was a part of Operation Pocket Money. I was a part of Task Force 77, and we mined Haiphong Harbor. And, of course, that was the first use of naval mines against North Vietnam. But they had talked about it for years. This was 1971.
Mm-hmm.
1972 it took place, but I was there on the line in 71. And this was May 72.
And I want to tell you, Pierre references that in his book, and he said that had that in the bombing. They'd been bombing before, but when they bombed and mined Haiphong Harbor, that saving blow to their economy.
Yep. Absolutely.
Very significant.
And, you know, we had navigation down. I mean, there was some real concerns, but it was decisive. And,
yes.
You know, and so I hope you name your book that with the permission of your friend, because I just think it needs to be revisited now that the hostility from the college kids and all this other kind of stuff, you know, supposedly they were taking the higher moral ground, which I doubt very much. And now at least we could look at more objectively. And I think it'll do a great deal for those who sacrifice so much. You know, I told you I spoke with someone who was, we're talking about what was going on in college campuses, but in comparison to the mental, emotional, and all the deaths that took place with these young men and women.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think that's an important piece.
Okay. Now there's another book. There's another book, and I am forgetting the author's name. I think it's Robert Thomas or something, Thompson, like that. He was a veteran of the British Malaysian insurgency, counterinsurgency, and they won that one. And I read his book, and before I started reading Pierre's book, Vietnam's American War, and he wrote his first version of that book was published in, I think, 68 or whatever. But he went back to Vietnam, I think, 70, and he wrote a final chapter. He's very critical of the American conduct of the war up to 68. That's Westmoreland years. Because, you know, he said, it's like three different wars. You have your military operation, then you have your civic action and the politics and all that. And he says it all has to be, you know, the work by the State Department and the work by the military has to be synchronized. And when he went back in the 70s, and by that 70, and when by that 69, 70, and by that time, Abrams is the general in charge, he said, it was all synchronized. It now had become, they fixed everything. It was one war, and he was seeing the results, okay? Then Pierre Athlon's book, that seriously the North Vietnamese were admitting they were really losing the war after 16. You know, we'll talk about the effect of the Tet Offensive, the 1968 Tet Offensive.
68, yeah.
All right, so to set the stage, we first have to – oh, when Pierre got up to give his presentation, that was the real eye-opener. He said the Americans did not even know who they were fighting.
Huh.
They thought they were fighting Ho Chi Minh and Bo Nguyen Giap, that Giap was the general in charge. And I'm telling you, in my research, when I was studying about the Vietnam War, I was studying Giap. He wrote a book, People's Wolves Army. Giap was not the commanding general. He's not the Minister of Defense during the Vietnam War. Ho Chi Minh had been pushed out of power, okay, by Le Duc Tho and Le Duan. Le Duan, as Pierre pointed out, he goes, these are the hardliners. See, Ho Chi Minh was a moderate. He was an intellectual. You know, he lived in France. He read the French. He was inspired by the French Republic and the Enlightenment, and he actually believed. You know, the problem was the French colonists were assholes, okay? The British are much more acquiescent, okay? And that's why you'll find that the British tend to do a lot better and this is why they still have Canada and Australia, because it's like, okay, you guys want independence here. We'll allow you to be independent. You can rule yourself, but guess what? You're part of the Commonwealth. You're part of the United Kingdom. Okay, so you're kind of like your own sovereign nation, but you're still part of us. They know how to handle it. The French didn't. The French, it was just all or nothing. And they were their own worst enemies. And Haiti is a result of the worst of the French culture. Okay, so so Ho Chi Minh will, and with his favorite general, Giap, will defeat the French, all right, and they will negotiate a peace. Now, there's this division between the hardliners. You see, in communism, and when I was teaching for your wife, right? One of the in one of the classes we were into that, the 1870s to right before World War One, and what was going on. And well, if Karl Marx and his ideas were spread, and there was the debate as to whether this could only be achieved by violent revolution, or there was a lot of, especially in, you know, like England and other countries, like, no, we can peacefully achieve this through the vote. We can vote in communism, which is like what the progressives are trying to do in our country. But the hardliners, like Lenin, will believe, no, it can only be achieved through violence, okay? And so what you had in you know, there was a conflict between Ho Chi Minh and the hardliners, which is Lê Đức Thọ and Lê Duẩn, as to we can peacefully negotiate or we can only go for violence. And Ho, Uncle Ho, he realized, he said, look, see, he accepted a partitioned Vietnam. So you have the supposedly democratic South Vietnam and the communist North Vietnam, and you have the communists in Vietnam, South Vietnam, really felt like they were left out there hanging, and they felt betrayed, because keep in mind the communists were gaining a lot of ground. So when they say we accept the partition dividing Vietnam from North Vietnam and South Vietnam, those communists who had been fighting down there felt like they got betrayed. And Lê Duẩn was also from South Vietnam. I think he's from Quang Tri. Okay, so, but they were very, and this is what is interesting in Pierre's book, is Lê Duẩn is very critical of Ho Chi Minh for accepting the partition solution. And Ho's point was, and it was like, okay, we need to go back on the offensive. And, you know, Ho's like, look, the Americans are back in the South. We do not want to get in a fight with the Americans because they have unlimited resources. That's how he saw it. The United States is too big. Unlimited manpower, unlimited weapons, tanks, everything. Vietnam, he said, we should focus on reforms, building our country up, building a base before we ever try to take them on. Okay. And the thing is, to fast forward to 1673, the mining of the, you know, we'll talk about the military operations and how both the VC and the NBA were destroyed twice, okay? And so by 72, when we're bombing North Vietnam and we mine the harbor, they're on the ropes. It's over. They're ready
and
to throw in the towel.
Let me mention something about that.
The partition solution. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, it was on May 9th, and of course, simultaneously, the president, Nixon, was announcing it, but it says, where the location, Haiphong, result, United States victory, successful blockade of North Vietnam. And, you know, just getting back to your thing about winning, doing something that really crippled them, doing something that should have been done before, and it has my ship, and we had the 1st Marine Squadron in the Vietnam War, and it mentions all the different commanders of the different air wings and, you know, everything that they carried. I actually took pictures when I was there, because it had to be a newspaper, but I actually took real pictures and sent them home. And so, you know, we have to reevaluate, you know, what was really driving the whole narrative. Was it just because of the condition of the culture? I mean, you know, even President Clinton, you know, he went back 30 years, but he wouldn't go at that time. And so there was certainly a reluctance and always this whole thing of whether it was just or unjust and all these atrocities like My Lai and things of that nature. But,
right.
You know, when it comes to our superiority, as you're stating, then we have to give credit where credit's due, that we did our job.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Now, this is a question I have of you. All right. And I'm going to set the stage for this is, see, here's the problem with, you know, throwing the baby out with bed. We lost that war. There's nothing to learn. Man, we developed so, I mean, our army, the innovation, the initiative that our army had, our armed forces, okay, we developed the air assault concept. We perfected it in Vietnam, okay? When we get into Khe Sanh, it's like, okay, how are you going to be, you know, during the Khe Sanh siege, well, the airport's open. So we're going to land C-130s there. Well, the problem is it gets blown up. Once it's parked, they mortar that thing, rocket it, you damage an aircraft. Now the runway's blocked, okay? So the Air Force is like, fix the problem. How do you do this? And they're going, hey, we don't have to land. Why don't we just have a drag chute on a pallet? So we're going to – well, we land, but we don't stop. So they'll land, drop the ramp, land, open the chute. The chute will pull the pallet out, or they just fly over the runway, drop the chute. That's what they were doing, dropping the cargo. And the chute would pull it out and slow it down, and the plane just keeps going. Lifts up, gets altitude. We call it LAPES. The Air Force still trains it. It was a very effective solution. As I mentioned, convoy ambushes, September 2nd, 1967, the enemy realized the soft underbelly of the 1st Cavalry Division was its dependency on trucks for everything it needed to fight. So they went after the convoys. Guess what? You know, Q Corps commander decided, hey, we got to protect these guys. Let's just put a lot of static positions out, checkpoints out there. Well, the enemy's going to hit you where there's no check. Each checkpoint would have like a tank. The 4th Mechanized Division was out there. So they put like tank and APC. Okay. And so they, the enemy's not going to hit you where that checkpoint is. They're going to hit you someplace else. So the truck drivers realized they got to defend themselves. And in fact, the whole doctrine, and when I taught convoy security, I said the purpose of the gun truck is immediate protection of that convoy and the drivers until the quick reaction force arrives, which is usually 10 to 15 minutes out, okay? I mean, we perfected convoy security. Well, we didn't. I mean, there were still questions left unanswered. When Vietnam ended, and we were able to finish that in the Iraq and Afghan wars, okay? But we basically came to the same conclusion, and we took it a little bit further. So, all right. But we did a lot of great things. And in fact, all right, so the North Vietnamese saw the war pretty much in three aspects. One, Arvin. Army, for anybody who's not familiar with the term, Army of the Republic of Vietnam. That's the South Vietnamese. And
right.
To defeat the military, win militarily, which they didn't. In fact, they got defeated. Win international support and defeat the American morale. They failed in two of the three. They succeeded in defeating the American commitment to the war. And we'll get to that and how they did that, okay? So, now, the Vietnam War, they began fighting. We're going to use the term the VC. I think they referred to themselves as the National Liberation Front, the NLF. And And then we refer to the North Vietnamese Army, NVA. They refer to them as the People's Army of Vietnam.
Democratic Republic of Vietnam, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to use that. Yeah, that's the term for the country, but their army was called, they referred to their army as the PAVN. We refer to them as NVA. All right, so when you use the terms VC and NVA, if you read Pierre's book, he'll refer to them by how they refer to themselves. Okay, so so basically the VC is like, okay, we want to get on. All right, there was supposed, according to the Geneva Convention, there was supposed to be a vote north and south for reunification. And here's the thing, it was rigged. Let me tell you, no one in the North is going to be, it was cruel. The reform was cruel. Seriously, if they knew there was an option, they wouldn't vote for it, I guarantee you. I mean, they wouldn't vote for communism. But at the same time, they claim that in the South, Diem, who was the president of South Vietnam, knew that he would lose the election, that they would lose the vote, and that Vietnam would be unified as a communist country. Okay. Now, so they don't have the vote. So the VC organization, their leadership, they want to go on the offensive. All right. Now, in Pierre's book, he talks about first of all, the Soviets are like, hey, just do guerrilla warfare. We're trying to do containment here. Stalin is dead. Khrushchev is in. So we got our own problems. Don't complicate it. The Chinese are going, it's kind of like, keep it as a guerrilla war, but don't go in with battalions and regiments. Well, so they wage guerrilla war, but in fact, the book I'm reading by Bu Tin, he went down and surveyed the Ho Chi Minh Trail twice, once in 1961, when it was primarily bringing supplies down, and the second time was 1964, when they were looking at bringing in battalions and regiments. And he's there. He said, this is the time, and it's concurring with Pierre Esselin's book says, is they were looking, it was Le Duan, their leadership, they've already removed Ho Chi Minh because they're saying they're making this gamble. Let's go big. Let's not listen to what the Chinese communists are telling us by just let's wear them down to real war. No, let's go in big. Let's go in with battalions and stuff like that. And he did. And here's the thing, King Gaines. So even with the helicopter, so we send our first helicopter, two helicopter companies to Vietnam in December 1961. We usually consider the advisor phase of Vietnam is 1962. And that's when first American troops, I got to meet, and he wrote a book. It's a great book. He was the S3, the operations officer for this one helicopter company. He said, we set foot in Vietnam in December 1961, not 1962. So they were the first, all right? And see, the thing
it's
is
funny,
we were sending
advisors. That's what our medal has on, 62. That's interesting.
Yes.
Because
so
the medal,
62
the
is considered.
Says, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
So
no,
62
see,
is considered the beginning of the advisor
here,
phase.
The flag I have, it says 61 to 75. It says 61, but I verified
what okay.
you just said. I always
right.
thought it was.
Well,
I have a flag.
Yeah. That's why.
Yeah.
Because this helicopter company arrived. Is it right before? It's late 61 that they arrived in Vietnam, got off the boat. Okay, so we have advisors with the ARVN units, but they are being supported by helicopter companies, and these are real primitive helicopters like H-19s and things like that. Well, no, the Huey's not there. Huey doesn't show up until we take over the ground war in 65.
Okay.
We're looking at banana-shaped helicopters, okay? Well, anyway. The Arvin Army is, look, with the coup d'etat, the problem with the Arvin is the fact that after the assassination of Diem, the coup, everybody that replaces him is more afraid of a coup d'etat than losing to the communists, because they believe we're not going to back out on this one, all right? So they intentionally appoint incompetent generals. They're more worried about loyalty than winning. Okay, so that's one fundamental problem of the Arvin, all right? But even then, at the lower levels, they're still screwed up. And I think the most famous battle is the Battle of Op Bak, where they had everything. They had APCs, armored personnel carriers. They had helicopters. They had numeric superior forces. And they got the VC in a bad spot, and the VC kicked their butts, okay? And from that time on, it goes downhill. And it's like by 64, this is where Westmoreland, who is saying, look, they're going to lose. The enemy is outside Saigon. They're taking all the major pot. Oh, and that's the thing that this guy wrote about. He said, see, before, the Chinese were telling them just to wage guerrilla warfare, stay in the jungles, avoid the populated areas. And this guy, he's part of a group of officers, North Vietnamese officers, that, one, have to evaluate the Ho Chi Minh Trail and then get in the south and start evaluating the strategic hamlets project, which is all these villages that are surrounded by, you know, ditches and barbed wire and stuff like that. And he comes back and says, yeah, we can take these on, all right? And so that's when they send in. And they go against the Chinese advice, and they start attacking villages and cities, okay? They're gaining ground. So Westmoreland goes to President Johnson, who is after Kennedy. See, Kennedy was assassinated like weeks after Diem coup, okay?
Right.
And so he says, if we do not go over the ground war, South Vietnam will fall. It will fall because the enemy is approaching Saigon. Now, when I first studied the incremental increases in Vietnam, this is the way I was taught, right? And then when I had that one conference, there was one historian that covered something, and I went and conferred with him, and he agreed with me. Okay. I was told that Westmoreland went to Johnson and said, I need 500,000 men, 500,000 men. I need 500,000 men. And Johnson said, no, I can only give you 125,000. So they fight for a year. They're not winning. And Westmoreland goes back to Johnson and says, I need 500,000 men. He said, well, I can only give you 125,000 more. Okay. And he gets it. And then after another year of fighting, they're not winning. And Westmoreland goes back and says, I need 500,000 men. And he finally gets it. That's not what happened. Johnson approved 500,000 men. He approved what Westmoreland asked for. The problem was, one, we didn't have 500,000 men to give him. That's why we have to increase the draft. Second thing is, we did not have the strategic lift. When I say as a transporter, strategically, I'm talking about the boats, because the first units to go to Vietnam went over on ships. Now, the second year of the war, we figured it out. And we're going like, hey, we can fly these guys in. So the second year of the war, they will ship the equipment over by boat and fly the personnel over on aircraft. And that becomes the way we deployed all wars since then. 95% of the passengers will deploy to theater by air. 95% of their equipment will go by ship. Okay? That's how it was in Vietnam.
Right, my son.
After the second year. All right. But the thing was, we did not have the lift capability nor the personnel resources to be able to give McNamara, I mean Westmoreland, $500,000 men. So it's planned from the beginning in three increments. All right. Now, so what Westmoreland, his strategy was, the first one is the enclave system. In other words, let's defend the key areas, the ports, four main seaports, and we're going to build these little enclaves around them. That's the first year of the war. That includes Saigon. Second year of the war, now we will expand out. Third year of the war, we'll continue the third increment. Actually, with the expansion the second year, they're going on the offensive. But believe it or not, anybody who's watched the movie We Were Soldiers Once or read the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young about the first Cav and the Battle of Ancay, they were at Ancay. What was, forgot the battle. Yadrang, the Battle of Yadrang. Okay.
Yeah.
No, we're going on the offensive that first year. Now, that was different because the French were defeated in 54 in two areas. One, Dien Bien Phu in North Vietnam, and the other was the annihilation of French Mobile Group 100 in the Central Highlands along Quy Nhon with Pleiku. Okay. And so Westmoreland accurately predicted that if South Vietnam would fall, the enemy strategy would be to divide it in half in the Central Highlands, which will happen in 74-75. Divide it through Central Highlands, defeat the north half, and then come down to the south. Okay. So the one exception to the enclave system was to place a brigade in Pleiku, okay, to control the other side of QL-19. All right. So, and it goes
according to plan. I want to mention something
now,
that you said about President Johnson. A friend of mine, he passed now. I used to teach for him, and his name was Paul Bankett. He was a test pilot during Vietnam, and he actually was in a meeting with President Johnson. It's very interesting what you're sharing about Westmoreland and, the whole thing with the draft and the whole reluctance there and how much there was, I won't say micromanagement, but there was definitely dialogue at a high level. Because of the lack of men as far as resources are concerned.
Right. Okay. You talked about the micromanagement. I think that was primarily by the air. And I've heard that complaint by aviators, naval aviators in particular, where normally if you turn it over to the Air Force or the Navy, the Air War, they're going to go, let's hit the important targets first and then work our way down on priority. Whereas literally Johnson and McNamara planned airstrikes. That's micromanaging.
Because
okay?
The Joint Chiefs of Staff, Thomas Moore, ordered the Chief of Naval Operations, Elmo Zumwalt, to plan the naval mining. So it definitely wasn't, you're on the ground, you make the decision. It was, from the top.
One of the bad lessons from Vietnam. One of the things we learned, there's several things we learned from Vietnam, okay, from the mistakes. One is the president needs to tell the armed forces what he wants accomplished. And then he's got to trust them to accomplish that. Okay. All right. And the second thing is, and we'll get into the Tet Offensive and the consequences of it, is you got to be real honest with the people. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So bring that up when I talk about the Tet Offensive. That was where we – all right. If you want to talk about the three-pronged approach to winning the war, okay, military, international support, home front. We lose the home front through the media. Okay. All right. And there's a mistake, and the Army studied that. And the way we conducted the war in Iraq and Afghanistan was based on the lessons, the honesty. For example, we'll lie about anything. You know, so there are the enemy is saying, hey, you just bombed a wedding. The Army goes study it. And if it turns out, yeah, we mistakenly, they were shooting AK-47s in there to celebrate, and somebody flew over and killed all these guys because they thought they were drawing ground fire. And the Army goes like, yeah, we fucked up on that one. And they admit it. The thing is, by doing that, we realized people trusted us. If you screw up and admit it, you do not lose the trust. Yeah, this is really bad. The consequence of lying and trying to cover up are far worse than admitting it. That's a lesson we got from Vietnam. Okay. So we talk about the three phases, right? Now, keep in mind, there are three major during the Vietnam War while the Americans were there. 64, okay, and they're gaining a lot of ground. 68 and 72.
I know somebody who's in that. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Well, here, the Easter Offensive, 72.
One of my
you notice there are four-year increments. 64, wait, let's look at 64, 68, 72. Four-year intervals. Why?
Right.
Mm-hmm. What did they coincide with?
You were
alive during that time. Election.
Right. Different elections.
Presidential elections. The enemy waged their major offensives based on influencing the elections here in the United States. Okay. Now, now the biggest criticism of Westmoreland's strategy is, and now what I just told you, we start with the enclave in 65, we expand that. Oh, the idea was the second year we begin to expand operations. The third increment, so you got 65, 66, 67. By 67, we're closing the gap between these regions. So, like with 67, I think it's a brigade of the 101st shows up, and it goes in. It's trying to close in the gap between I Corps and Northern II Corps. They go in and land at Sao Win, and they begin to open up, QL1, the coastal highway. So basically by 67, we're gaining ground. We are now, gaining better control. But the criticism of Westmoreland was the strategy of attrition warfare. Are you familiar what I mean by attrition warfare?
No, but I want to know how long was Westmoreland
68,
in charge?
68 when he gave up. Yeah, he was
okay.
I don't remember when he took over, but he Abrams replaced him in 68. After the Tet Offensive.
Okay.
And it wasn't a relief. It was like Westmoreland had been there for his 3 or 4 years. And so now it's Abrams' turn to come in. General Abrams, Creighton Abrams, tanker, comes in as his deputy, and then we'll replace him, and he changes his strategy. But here's the issue. Okay. So Westmoreland's original strategy, as I described, with the expansion of forces, is to bring in U.S. combat forces, take over the war, drive the enemy onto the defensive. The first year is a defensive operation, defend the supply depots. But hey, First Cav just tears ass through the jungle. Okay, because, hey, that's the other thing. The French are the first to do a helicopter air assault. But I'm going to tell you, the American Army perfected air assault in Vietnam, okay? And it's a concept that we use in recent wars today, okay? And we did, militarily, wasn't so much that was great. That's the whole point.
Mm-hmm.
And even the, you know, when you read Pierre's book, the North, you know, LeDuan and all the guys admitted they got their butts handed to them several times. Their army was destroyed. Okay. Now, so the whole concept of going on the offensive is good. And if you look at the Army's new manual, and the, written by historians, well, experts in counter-search, I think McChrystal was involved in the writing of it. And it's like the first phase of the operation is to buy time to train up the host nation military. If you look at the Philippine insurrection, you will see that. The Americans took the bulk of the fighting for the first couple of years, and while they were doing it, they were training up the Philippine constabulary, and then you slowly began to integrate the Philippine constabulary into American military operation till they gain experience. Then you begin to have them supporting your operation until they get good enough. Then you can step back and support their operations till finally you turn them loose. Those are the phases of training a host nation military. And so
the 10th offensive was after Westmoreland.
No, it's
right
the end of Westmoreland's tour. It's the end of Westmoreland's tour.
Okay.
It's during the transition.
A friend,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was in 3rd Brigade in my old neighborhood with my Vietnam hat on. He said, "Where'd you get that?" I earned it. And he told me he was in the 3rd Brigade. He's a religious man, was praying.
3rd Brigade what?
Big man.
Wait, 3rd Brigade what?
82nd
huh?
Airborne. 82nd Airborne.
Oh, okay. The only brigade of the 82nd to go to Vietnam. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, he was certainly there, and it was great to share with him because that was a real turning point, correct?
Yes. All right, but I'm not a big fan of the 82nd, okay? They're like the last ones in and the first ones out. All right. I mean, you want a good unit. All right. The 107, the 173rd Airborne Brigade was considered the reserve. All right. So you look at, here's how you conduct. All right. If you're going to study the Vietnam War, for any of the listening audience out there, and it was really interesting because when I was at West Point, all our instructors were Vietnam vets.
Sure.
Senior captors or majors. They're all Vietnam vets. And we're studying military history, and I asked him, I said, how come no one teaches us? You guys got firsthand experience. How come no one teaches us a class on the Vietnam War? And the professor looked at me and goes, because it's too personal. And it didn't mean like, okay, it's too emotional. No, what he meant was the war was a different experience for everybody.
Right.
He said,
you can't
it's
be
going
objective.
To have to be you. Yeah. And here I am. I'm educating everybody. He said, it's going to have to be you who writes and teaches about the war because you could
That's
be
great.
Objective about it. He said, it was a different war depending on where you were, when you were there, and who are you with? And because I'd done, because I was doing all my interviews with the truck drivers in Vietnam, I already knew the war. So I'd go in, I'd sit down with my pre-interview was, what company were you with? Where were you at? And when? And when he told me that, like, okay, I know what questions to ask. Because it's a different war. Year to year, place to place. You know, whether you're in QL9, you're in 8th group. If you're in 8th group, and depending on the year, it's a different war than if you're in the 48th group. You know, 8th group was in Northern 2 Corps, and the 48th group was down there at Long Bend in 3 Corps, okay? It's a different war.
Did you ever talk to our good friend Doc Washburn about his 4 or 5 deployments? Did you ever talk to him?
He wouldn't talk. Doc wouldn't talk about it. Yeah, Doc was Doc Washburn was a door gunner in the Yadrang Valley battle. He was a door gunner in that fight. Those helicopters flying in, One of the guys in behind the M60 is Doc Washburn. Okay,
yeah,
he wouldn't talk about
some
it.
Stories. He told me some stories about how brutal the South Koreans were to the Vietnamese.
Oh, gosh. The truck driver told me all about it.
Yeah.
See,
and
you got
another
understand.
Friend who was a Marine Corps gunner who was reservist or National Guard. He was an E-8. Became good friends with him, and he became a Christian after many, many years. But he was a gunner in the Marine Corps at 19 years old, and he told me quite a few stories of how God really had to, you know, give him forgiveness because he couldn't justify it. He said he didn't darken the door of a church for 10 years. But I don't know if you remember him. I had to cover one of the battalions, and I'm still friends with the sergeant major that was there. So, I mean, we have friends that, you know, saw some real action, and some of the truck drivers that were in the T school when we were there. I forget the one gentleman's name, but he was also a
Gene
Vietnam
Autry.
Vet.
Gene Autry.
Yes.
Gene Autry.
Now,
that's who you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. Gene Autry and Doc Washburn were the two Vietnam vets.
Yep.
Yes. No, I have Gene Autry's interview. He was up in I Corps. I think the 57th Truck Company. And I could talk about these guys and eat up all our time. But, he has a very interesting interview. I got it really – you know, he's one of those guys who could talk about the ambush and not get emotional about it. In fact, I mean, it was funny listening to him. And everybody – you know, here's the thing I'm going to tell you, all right, for veterans, okay, when you're talking to them. I have come to learn that everybody has a propensity for fear and pain or a tolerance, okay?
Right.
So your SF guys and stuff like that, they have a much higher threshold for pain and fear. So they can go through a lot of experiences, and it doesn't affect them as much as it may be that guy that got drafted. That got sent over there. Now, keep in mind, that's not an indictment on the guys get drafted. There's a bunch of, I mean, seriously, when we start, you know, I wrote the book, Lomsom, you know, Get the Cargo Through. And now most all those enlisted guys were draftees. They're,
right.
You know, it's like, hey, you know, the thing they told me was we didn't volunteer, but when we were called upon, we served. And they all had fathers, uncles, grandfathers who had served in the war. They were fulfilling. They weren't reluctant warriors. They waited. They got called, and they went, okay? And they did their job. They rose to the occasion. And here's the thing that I love about truck drivers. Like, there is a love affair between a truck and a truck driver. And if you shoot at this truck, you cast him off. Okay.
Right,
there's nothing more dangerous than a damn truck driver defending other truck drivers, and he's got a lot of machine guns to do it with. That's a gun truck. That's why I love writing about these guys. And so for Lomsom 71, it was the Laotian incursion. Those guys were heroes. Those guys were heroes. But anyway, so. I'm doing an overview. All right, so let's get to the Tet of 68 because we're getting close to 30 minutes left. Okay, so the Tet of 68. Now, things are not going well for the South Vietnamese Army, and they've been reinforced NVA regiments. Okay, now, if you talk to vets, you talk about when you have VC, there's that farmer by day, guerrilla by night. But there are what we call main force VC. No, these guys are full-time guerrillas. But the NVA were always considered a more significant threat simply because they were trained. They were trained before they came down there. They are the professional army, better trained. Whereas the VC, they're doing their training while they're living in the jungle. Okay, so. Lê Duan realizes he's losing the war. By 67, things are turning against him. Oh, Oh, I know what I wanted to say. The attrition warfare strategy. That comes under a lot of criticism. The basis of that was the fact that when you look at the Battle of Yadrang Valley, and the enemy, that the NVA considered that a victory, even though they won. See, for them, it wasn't about holding ground. They got, I mean, by it, it, how do you define victory? Okay, if your intention was your intention to destroy this unit, you failed to do it, you lost. Was it to seize this ground? You seize the ground and then you give it up? No. What the NVA commander wanted to do was inflict damage into the first cap. And in fact, they actually defeat one battalion. I think that's LZ X-ray. Okay, if you're the movie only focuses on how Moore's experience, but you read the book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, It talks about the almost annihilation of another battalion, okay, which has a lot of similarity to in the leadership style and stuff what happens to Custer at Little Bighorn. Okay, but they take massive casualties, but they don't get defeated. Okay, but the enemy learns from this, and the enemy's lesson is cause. And here's what the Americans did very well: fire support. They brought everything in. They could coordinate fast movers, air. They could coordinate helicopter gunships and artillery. They could bring all this to bear against the enemy. And the enemy realized that if you're going to fight the Americans, you've got to grab them by the belt buckle. You've got to get that close to them. So if they're calling airstrikes in on you, guess what? It's going to land on the Americans. And in fact, there's a number of silver stars. You know, it's like, hey, if you call an airstrike on yourself, you're getting a silver star. If you watch the movie Platoon, that's what happens. The enemy knows you've got to get close with them. So they overrun the camp, and that's where Dale Dye is the actor playing the company commander. You know, he says, drop all remaining ordnance on my paws. And to clarify that, he goes, yeah, the enemy owns it. And so that was not uncommon. Okay. So 68. So LeDuan realizes, oh, there's two things going on. One, the American army is gaining ground. Their operation, attrition warfare. I got to go back to that. I addressed that. I keep getting distracted. Attrition warfare. That we drew the conclusion, if we fight more battles like this, I mean, we killed so many enemy soldiers in these battles that if we win enough more battles like this, the North Vietnam will run out of young men to send down here. So there becomes an emphasis on body counts. Every time there's a battle, what's the body count? What's the body count? Well, here's the problem. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem. So if the emphasis on body count, every time you go into battle, how many people did you kill? Well, you got to kill more people. So what does that lead to? Lying.
Brutality.
Falsified body counts. If you want, no one's going to count those dead civilians. They covered that up. Now, if you watch the movie Boys in Company C, and someone told me the scene where, you know, because the battalion commander's not out there with you. He's sending you out there on patrol and says, I need a body count. Right?
I get you.
So there's a scene where these guys have got lawn chairs and they're sitting there and they're calling this airstrike on this hilltop. There's nothing there. And they're calling back in this major battle and they're racking up dead bodies, okay, to make the battalion commander happy. That was the problem of the emphasis on the attrition warfare. But the whole concept of going after the enemy was buying time to train up the army. Now, the problem was that there's a lot of collateral damage. In the emphasis on going after the enemy, we were killing a lot of civilians in the process. You know, and the enemy would do things like shoot at you from a village, peaceful village. So you'd return fire, kill civilians. Guess what? You made enemies. Okay. just like we said in Afghanistan, for every innocent civilian you killed, you just made five more terrorists. Okay. All
right.
You just recruited five more people for the Taliban. Missouri, in the Civil War, for every Confederate sympathizer you imprisoned or killed, guess what? You just recruited five poor guerrillas, okay? It never ends. So anyway, LeDuan realizes at one, there's a lot of false information coming from his subordinate that the populace is ready. If we just come down with one major offensive, the populace will rise up. So there's a major miscalculation on the intelligence. But the other thing is, the war's not going very well for them. The Americans are gaining a lot of ground. They are gaining territory that used to belong to the NLF. So he needs a major offensive. And he believes, one, the major – and they go after major populated areas. That was a big part of it. They're fighting as conventional forces. They had tanks parked on the Ho Chi Minh Trail ready for this offensive. It was a conventional battle, not a guerrilla war. It was a conventional battle. Battles were fought at battalion level and above. And if you ever meet any American soldier or Marine who fought during the Tet Offensive, they will tell you, we kicked their asses. It's like, see, the biggest problem in fighting a guerrilla war was how elusive the enemy was. You're trying to hunt them down, pin them down. They're ambushing you and hitting you in raid. He said, they're fighting in Tet. They were fighting us on our own terms. We were good at that. The North Vietnamese will admit, I mean, one, we just,
I want to ask
was
you
very
a question.
Little. Go ahead.
You know, like I said, I have an acquaintance that was a part of the Tet Offensive, but also my former archbishop was a river rat. And I know even when we were there, you know, something like the USS Missouri, you know, was doing all this damage and stuff. How significant, I know they came under a lot of fire, were the river rats as far as...
All right. I'm glad you brought that up. I'm going to talk about two major... The key to the Vietnam War was cutting off infiltration routes, both for mainly for supply. All right.
Like we did.
From what I understand, the majority of supply that wasn't, it took 2 months to walk. They're pushing bicycles. They're resupplying the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Oh, well, no, actually they expanded it to trucks, but we're bombing it. So we're bombing B-52s or arc light, where it's like carpet. A lot of attacks on Ho Chi Minh. But in the first part of the war, the operation was called Market Time. And this was swift boats. I think they're like, I don't remember the size of them, 30-footers or something like swift boats. So the enemy was supplying the South by the coastline. So Operation Market Time, a Navy operation, basically severed that lifeline. So then the enemy decided to use the rivers. So they're going into Cambodia and Laos, and they're now pushing supplies by these little sampans and stuff like that. That's where the PBRs came in, all right? So Market Time is swift boats, and then you have the PBRs. The Navy is going up and down looking for sampans that are supplying the enemy, okay? And then, of course, we have the bombing. So you have to deny the enemy its ability. So the naval operation was very, very effective, and Pierre Esselin addresses that in his book, okay? So there's a greater reliance on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Like I said, it takes about 2 months to walk the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And you've got tigers, you've got all these things. Nature is working against you. So anyway, so the Tet Offensive
the
literally
came in,
Go ahead.
that's when Agent Orange came in.
Well, Agent Orange was, all right, I deal with that in the convoy security because the jungle grew right up to the road. So they wanted to defoliate the jungle so you could see, create distance between you and the enemy. And so they're pouring Agent Orange, which is kills plants, all right? That's what that was, okay?
They said we were exposed.
That's right. Okay.
Because of how often they used it, yeah.
But we're running short of time. So the Tet Offensive, okay. The Tet Offensive was a military failure for the VC and the NVA. Nearly annihilates the VC and significantly destroys the NVA. It failed militarily. It failed internationally. It did not rally any support from the Soviets. Basically, the Soviets and Chinese are saying, we told you so. But significant political gain on the American home front. You want to know why? Thank you, Walter Cronkite. Tell me about Walter Cronkite. Tell me about Walter Cronkite. Who was he? Before we say why was he respected?
He was a Mormon and one of the most respected commentators, along with Douglas Edwards and Robert Trout. You and I both remember them as kids.
Yeah.
And, he was highly respected.
So you're talking about your news anchor,
President
the
Kennedy's
evening
death,
news. Everybody watches the evening news. And one of the most news anchors, Walter Cronkite.
But do you remember when he announced President Kennedy's assassination?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. So tell us, what did he say? What did this guy say?
What, about our president being assassinated, you mean?
No.
Walter
Cronkite. He lost the American war. After the Tet Offensive, what did he say?
I don't recollect exactly. I just know that.
All right.
We couldn't.
So you're
going to
tell me how it was received. The thing was, he said, see, you got to understand.
Couldn't be one.
Those very few of the journalists were actually going into combat. Most of them were hanging around Saigon. Walter Cronkite, a very respected guy. This guy is not going to be beating the bush. He's hanging around Saigon. Problem was, when I talk about how the American Army deals with press, Johnson was pressuring Westmoreland to constantly put a positive view on this. So all the press, the 5 o'clock follies, when Westmoreland's up there every day, 5 o'clock, in time for the news, giving a press brief and telling how we're winning the war, and all of a sudden the enemy goes on the offensive and starts taking city, gets destroyed doing it, military disaster. But for the press, who hides in the comfort of Saigon, and they see this,
right.
We were lied to. They were telling us we're winning, and now the enemy has gone on this offensive. How could it happen? So Walter Cronkite gets up there and tells the American people that
we have to
accept that we have lost this war and we have given it their best effort and we have to negotiate an honorable withdrawal. You got the guy on the ropes and you're beating the crap out of him. You're about to knock him out and your coach is tired of seeing the blood and he throws the towel in. That's what Walter Cronkite did. And so you tell me what happened after the Tet Offensive. Military victory on the American side. What happened back home?
Thanks
to Walter Cronkite.
And all the riots?
That's right.
All the protests?
Well, it gave energy to the anti-war movement. It gave energy to that. For Ted Kennedy and all, everybody who is all the politicians against the war, it energized the war. We won militarily. If you read the Vietnamese account, they admit they got destroyed. Okay, so thank you, Walter Cronkite. All right, so then we go into 72. Leg one, all right. Oh, after that, the war changes. So Abrams takes over, and now by this time we have bought ground. Oh man, the VC are destroyed. The NVA, all right. From that time on, the VC, the Bain Force VC exists on paper as South Vietnamese Army, but it is filled with replacements from North Vietnam. And these guys tattooed on their arms, born in the North to die in the South. Because that's what they were. So the VC existed as they were as paper as a South Vietnamese Army or guerrillas, but they were really all North Vietnamese guys. Okay. So Abrams comes in and the war changes. Abrams, in his mind, Westmoreland's concept of, you know, the Americans doing all the fighting and the attrition war was wrong approach, that we need to get the Arvin more engaged. That's a logical process. And, right. And the whole thing is, for 3 years, the American has fought the brunt of the war, expanded out operations, been able to train up the Arvin, and now it's time to bring them in. So in Abrams' strategy is, now let's get the American Army back to defending villages, and let the Arvin go on the offensive. Okay. So that's a major shift. And as Robert Thomas wrote, that they synchronized the strategic, you know, the political side, the civic action side, everything. All of a sudden, we're doing it right. He comes back there and says, you're doing it right. And even Lee Dewan admit, like, the Americans were really doing it right. There. And the Phoenix Project. Okay, what was the Phoenix Project? Go after the infrastructure. Go it all mm-hmm. the people to support. The, you know, we think of the guerrillas as the guys with the guns. The vast majority of it is, as Mao would write about, is a guerrilla swimming in a sea of support. You've got to take the support. Right. So when the NVA battalions and regiments were marching down south to fight in South Vietnam, they were expecting to draw their food, all their support from the locals from there. You have got to deny them that. So the Phoenix Project, which is a special forces operation, basically all the critics will say it was a witch hunt. It was basically, hey, you're cute. You get somebody, you accuse them of being a guerrilla, and then you make the, you know, either you confess and turn in the others, or we kill you or torture you and stuff like that. But guess what? It worked. It was turning over, insert, you know, because you didn't have to carry an AK-47 to be an insurgent. You just had to be a part of the infrastructure. You tax and ambushing tax collectors was a common thing.
Play the devil's advocate a little bit as we're wrapping up. I did
go ahead
teaching on the My Lai massacre when I was at the
My Lai
Peace School.
My Lai.
About 300.
Right.
Yeah, I have it.
Yeah.
Was MYLAI, but I have it written.
Yeah.
My Lai. And about 350. Senior NCOs, and you know, the whole Captain Medina and Lieutenant Cowley, but also I know even among our guys there was opium, drugs, lack of discipline.
Right.
So that
right.
also came into play. So even as we're telling the story, and there's a lot of glory and a lot of valor, there wasn't a lot of virtue in some situations. So I don't know.
Towards
if we
the end of the war,
all right.
I'm gonna tell you this. All right, so I sat in on a lecture, and the guy was given, yeah, I know, and I'm going to sit in on a lecture, and this guy was going, the myth of Vietnam, breaking up the myth of Vietnam, and one of the myths is the drug use. He claimed that it wasn't as bad as they said. I said, where the hell did you get your research? And he said, it was based on a drug analysis test here in the United States. I said, you're looking in the wrong place. All the druggies were going to Europe because they weren't doing your analysis there, and you could get easy drugs in in Amsterdam. And they go, well, if it was that bad, you know, we'd hear. I said, it was horrible in Germany from 1973 to 1975, or no, even later than that when I got there, okay? And the point being is, you know, when I interviewed the vets, you never ask them about drug use, right? They'll tell you. If you don't ask,
studies,
if you
though,
ask them.
Studies.
Mm-hmm. All right, and what did your studies reveal?
Revealed that a lot of them did not stay addicted when they got home. It was probably a coping mechanism. And, yeah, I saw some pretty extensive studies. And
yeah, here's the thing I found.
For the most part.
Right, just to address that issue. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Up until 68, there are probably enough guys with bad habits. Marijuana. Okay, marijuana was the drug of choice. That you could feel a squat. By 69, now you're getting a lot more draftees and stuff, the attitude toward the war. You look at what's going on, the hippie movement stuff. You now have enough dopers to feel a platoon, okay?
Mm-hmm.
By 70, half the company is either smoking dope or they're alcoholics, okay?
Yep.
And
yep,
that's the pattern I found. That's the pattern. Mm-hmm. The problem was you could get heroin cheap and pure in Vietnam. And so in the early part of the war, it's primarily marijuana. But by the end of the war, you got guys strung out on heroin, okay? And that was creating some severe discipline problems. But I'm going to tell you this.
Yep.
In spite of that.
What was the year of the My Lai massacre?
I don't remember. I don't remember. It was early. It was like 68. Yeah, something like that. It was early. Then the thing was, the My Lai massacre was a result of the attrition warfare. Give me a body count. Give me a body count.
Yeah,
okay.
Right, right.
So that's
also,
why I think it was
pre-69. It was also retaliatory, though. It was retaliation. What had happened to one of their sister companies.
Yeah, because, look, guys are going in and they're drawing fire from a village, so they decide to annihilate the village. They wanted revenge.
And,
it
right,
was revenge.
They did some pretty
atrocious
things.
That's right. That's
right.
Okay. But that was an anomaly. Or, well, no, let me tell you. Guys, no, it wasn't an anomaly because, yeah, there was a lot. But I'm telling you right now.
The warrant officer, though,
warfare,
that intervened.
War is hell. Sherman said this, war is hell.
But the,
okay?
there was a warrant
and
officer,
it's always
Thompson,
going to be the...
Let me just mention this. The warrant officer, I believe he's one or two, helicopter pilot Thompson, he was the one who basically stopped the atrocity by, you know, almost being willing to shoot his own people because of what was taking place with a mass grave, with all the... stuff that was being done. So I mean, we need to look at both sides of the coin in saying that, yes, there's a lot more honor that came out of it, a lot more sacrifice that came out of it. But we also want to own up to those things that we didn't do because of the moral corruption that was taking place in our society, period, and the draft and the drugs, things of that nature.
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you right now. From the enemy's perspective, drugs didn't affect the American ability to kick their ass. Did not cut that back one iota. The American Army was a force to be reckoned with. They really focused on trying to defeat the Arvin soldiers. Okay. Now, now in Pierre's book, he points out the My Lai mass. All right. First of all, the mass graves in Hue during the Tet Offensive was a bad publicity for the NVA, all right, for their side of the war. But My Lai countered it, okay? My Lai was very bad press, all right? So you talk about the morality of – now, the thing was we definitely – that was a black eye. That was definitely a black eye on our part. Okay.
And people
now,
usually focus
on that. We got 10 minutes. So 72. 72. LeDuan, he makes one more gamble. They're not winning the war. They have VC soldiers like giving up. Like we're losing. There's no point. They're giving up on this. So he decides one more offensive. And all right, because by this time Yarvin is now taking the brunt of the fight. So it's like, we can beat these guys. Well, the problem is American air power. Okay. So they launch again. It's not a guerrilla war. It's not guerrillas coming. It is armor, North Vietnamese armor coming down, and they get armed. The biggest killer of tanks on the battlefield is air power. That's what it was in World War II. That's what it was in Vietnam. An American air power destroyed the Easter offensive of 72.
I was a part of the flight operations, but I just wanted mention something. I wear this band. I've worn it for years. Lieutenant Colonel Robert W. Brownlee and United States Army, 25 April 1972. And I've done research about him, and he was being tormented and tortured, and he committed suicide. That's what I understand from the accounts. He was a lieutenant, and this was April of 72 when we were still there. And you're absolutely right.
He was tortured. He was what? You didn't tell us. Was he a prisoner or did
tortured.
He come home? What?
No, he didn't. He committed suicide
in Vietnam. He was a prisoner in North Vietnam.
That's correct. And he committed.
Okay.
He
that's
was
what
a,
you left
I've read
out.
About
okay.
his
that's
life.
What
he's quite a tough
yeah.
guy
right.
and stuff, yeah. but he just wasn't going to be any further humiliated. And he,
yeah.
you know, that's
right.
what I've read. Now, I'm not trying to.
Oh, let me tell you. You know, the thing
time.
Is, we focus on the cruelty, you know, Mealy stuff. The enemy was doing was just as bad. All right, but we're running out of time. So LeDuan admitted he definitely miscalculated 68, 672. He has no army. It is destroyed, okay? And then you go in and mine Haiphong Harbor, and then, they miscalculate. He thinks Nixon is going to run when he says peace with honor. They think he will cave in, take any deal and get out of there. No, that's the other area LeDuan miscalculated. And it turns out Nixon, in the eyes of the North LeDuan, the enemy, was a very astute foreign policy guy because he starts negotiating with those countries, the Soviet Union and China, that are sustaining the war. He starts making friends with him. He makes inroads
he was there
with China.
When I was in Hong Kong, and they showed me this.
That's
is where
right.
The president
so
was.
The thing is,
but he
so,
took a
so
long
now
time
you've got your harbor
we
mind. Yeah, you've got your harbor mind bombing the hell out of your industry. Your factories are destroyed. And now you're being cut off by your two major supporters, the Soviet Union, Moscow, and Beijing. Okay. Thanks to Nixon. LeDuan now has to negotiating, and he's negotiating the very thing he criticized Ho Chi Minh for, a partition solution. They signed the Paris Peace Accords and for a partition solution. They agreed to Vietnam's. The very thing he was adamant against, he had to give
right.
in. Ho Chi Minh was right. Don't take on the Americans. And the Americans began to withdraw. They got the prisoners back. Unfortunately, Nixon had to resign because of Watergate. Nixon was resolved to defending South Vietnam. So, LeDuan will make one more gamble in 675. All right. The Arvin troops could have fought. The problem was we cut them off of two major things they needed to fight with. Ammunition. You run out of ammo. I don't care how brave you are. You don't have ammo, you can't fight. They get cut off ammo, and they are denied American air power. So I was there was one woman, teaches at the Naval War College, had pink hair, and she liked to like give this class on it, and she talked about how we lost the war. And I went up to talk to her, and I said, what if we kept troops there? See, here's the thing. Lai Duan knew. He learned the lesson that Ho Chi Minh had tried to tell him. Don't take on the American army. So had we withdrawn forces but kept a small force there, like we did the Philippines, not occupied, just like, hey, if there's a serious trouble, we can back you up, all right? It also shows our commitment to South Vietnam. Just as we found out in Afghanistan, you pull the troops out, that country will fold. They won't fight. Okay. And the thing was, she looked at me and go, because she had presented it, and she said every solution the officers present, she could refute. And I said, she goes, she looked at me and goes, how long? I said, 20 years, at least 20 years. She couldn't answer that. Lai Duan would be dead before 20 years. He's the only reason they fought that long, okay? We had won the Vietnam War. Things we did in that war were very successful. Militarily, we destroyed the Vietnam War. Our counterinsurgency doctrine is based on the lessons of Vietnam, the Philippine insurrection, the counterterrorist doctrine that we developed in Iraq and Afghanistan is based on the Phoenix Project. We reinvented convoy security. We reinvented. We didn't learn from Vietnam. We reinvented it, and we came to the same solution they did. There's a lot to learn from Vietnam, and every Vietnam veteran that was there should be proud of what they did because they won the war. All right, we got less than a minute. Close it out here. Yep. Give us a prayer, whatever.
Lord, we just ask you to bless our country, and I pray that we can beat our swords into plowshares, Lord, and be a fruitful nation, but give honor to where honor's due. I thank you for Rich clarifying so many things tonight, especially for us Vietnam vets that feel the pain of the way the country responded. I ask and pray in Jesus' name, Father, Son, Holy Spirit.